Okay, yeah, thank you all for coming, actually. So last time Leon said this is going to be a serious lecture. So serious, so I'm not sure what serious means. To me, serious probably means more equations. So I will write down more equations in the slide. So this talk is about a conventional, unconventional quantum computing point. It's basically, so conventional basically just means use of lambda formalism, just lambda Wilson Fisher. Type of fixed point in quantum system. And unconventional basically means everything beyond that. So in unconventional part, there's a lot of gauge field and vortex, monopoles, Gurmian, Weissmann, and all kinds of crap. So basically, so although this lecture is supposed to be serious, but I don't think I can be systematic, since it's hard to be systematic about all these kind of topics. So I will just give you a lot of examples. And some examples may be useful in code atom, and some examples might be interesting to simulate using all kinds of numerical method, which has been discussed in this program. Yeah, okay, so basically examples. So I will start with something very, very basic. This is a very typical, do I have a point, a laser point there? Oh, it's a pen. Okay, good. So this is a standard quantum critical point phase diagram. There's a tuning parameter, which can be pressure or magnetic field or doping or anything. There's a temperature, and there's a quantum critical point, a quantum critical regime, which is controlled by the thermal fluctuation as a quantum critical point. And the temperature is the main energy scale as the infrared. And you can find it at Wikipedia. So some basics about, so let me remind you some basic things about scaling and the renormalization group. This is like a standard James Landau theory with order parameter phi, and here phi is the icing. And then the R is the tuning parameter you can tune through the phase transition, and here tau means the time direction and the spatial derivative. And then actually, in a very large class of quantum critical points, all the scaling only depend on two numbers. One is the eta, one is mu. And the eta basically is defined as scaling dimension of the order parameter at the quantum critical point. So eta is called the anomalous dimension. Basically, it can be calculated by doing the calculate the correlation function between phi over space time. Another exponent is mu, which describes how the correlation length between phi diverges when we get close to the critical point. So if we know eta and nu, actually we can see the scaling dimension of phi. It looks like this. And then z basically is the ratio of the scaling dimension between time and space. And also if I knew the exponent mu, I know the scaling dimension of phi squared, which looks like this, z plus z minus 1 over nu. Okay, for a very large class of critical points, all the scaling properties only depend on these two numbers. So if this happens, then this system satisfies hyperscaling. It's what we call hyperscaling. Basically, the eta and nu is only two numbers we need to know all the scaling properties. Okay, so suppose the system, in addition to the tuning parameter R, we have another relevant perturbation, for instance, temperature. Then there are two relevant perturbations now. One is temperature, the other is the tuning parameter R. Certainly these two relevant perturbations at the quantum critical point will compete with each other. Certainly, so in the phase diagram, there's a crossover region between the temperature-dominated region and the R-dominated region. Basically, how do we calculate the crossover line? It's very simple, just to calculate the correlation length induced by finite T and the correlation length induced by finite R, and compare which one is shorter. If the correlation length induced by the temperature is shorter, then we are in a quantum critical regime where the physics is dominated by the thermal fluctuation, the temperature is the most important. And when the correlation length induced by R is shorter than T, it's shorter than the correlation induced by temperature, then we are in here. So the infrared cutoff is induced by R. So it's the phase diagram. And actually the crossover region can be called as T goes to R to Z nu. This is the rough scaling of the crossover region of the quantum critical region. Yeah, okay, so let me say a little bit more about the hyperscaling. Turns out the hyperscaling relation will hold when the d plus d, which is the total space time dimension, is smaller than 4, then the hyperscaling will hold. So when this is satisfied, then we only need to know e and u. And when d plus d is greater than 4, we actually lose the kind of ability. In the scaling function, we have to include some irrelevant perturbation. Irrelevant perturbation in the field theory will enter the scaling function. So sometimes this kind of perturbation is called dangerously irrelevant perturbation. But nowadays, this word dangerously irrelevant perturbation can mean different things. So I didn't write it down. But basically, it means irrelevant perturbation can enter the scaling function somehow. Suppose the hyperscaling is satisfied, then we can write down all kinds of equations we can imagine. As long as the two sides of the equation have the same scaling dimension, then this equation will hold. For instance, we can calculate how the order parameter scale with the tuning parameter R in the ordered phase. Then we can write down this kind of scaling power based on the scaling dimension between phi and R. And also we can calculate how the susceptibility diverge close to the quantum critical point. Again, we only need to write down the equation based on scaling dimension. As long as we satisfy scaling dimension on both sides, then this equation will be correct. Yeah, okay. So now let's consider a very simple example. Let's consider we want to calculate the TC, which is the finite temperature phase transition critical temperature, how TC is scaled with R. We want to consider this. Suppose the system is beyond the upper critical dimension, which means that d plus z is greater than 4. Suppose d plus z is greater than 4, then the calculation, we just write down some equation like this. So this is the effective R, which is the renormalized tuning parameter R, will equal to the original R plus g times the t to some power. And then this power actually just compensates the scaling dimension of g to match the scaling dimension of R. Basically, write down equation with the every term has the same scaling dimension. This is the only thing we need to guarantee. So as long as we write down this kind of equation, we can calculate TC goes to R to this power, z over d plus z minus 2. Okay, so this is like, I mean, this describes how this line, finite temperature, phase transition critical temperature scale with R. Okay, just write down this symbol. I mean, if you don't believe me, then you can just calculate some very simple loop diagram. For instance, calculate some very simple one loop diagram. This is plus. It's okay. You don't have to turn it out. So you know, calculate this kind of one loop phase. This kind of one loop diagram. You can show this equation actually is correct. Will emerge just a one loop calculation. And suppose the hyperscaling relation is satisfied, then we don't have to worry about the g anymore. Or we can just put the g as the fixed point value g star. And then the TC will go to the R to Z mu, which is the same scaling as the crossover line here. So basically, it means that if hyperscaling is satisfied, then actually everything is only determined by relevant perturbation instead of irrelevant perturbation. So when hyperscaling is satisfied, then both these two lines will scale with R to Z mu, this kind of scaling. Yeah, okay. So let me go back to talk about the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. And I just learned that Z Fisher is in the audience, which is actually a big flatter to me since. I'm going to talk about a quantum Wilson-Fisher fixed point, and I'm going to talk about how we realize the Wilson-Fisher fixed point as a quantum critical point. But let me first review some basic property of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So Wilson-Fisher fixed point basically is we're first discussing three-dimensional classical critical point. Certainly in quantum system, it will be two-dimensional with z equals to 1. Basically, the time has the same scaling as space. For 2 plus 1 dimension, we have Wilson-Fisher fixed point. For instance, this kind of model is called the ON model. It has the ON symmetry because it's the n component of the real boson here. And actually, this is a table of the two critical exponents, eta and nu. And actually, we can see that when n is bigger and bigger, the number mu will basically increase. And when n goes to infinity, nu will be 1. Okay. Here we only show 1, 2, 3, but 1 means the icing. Okay. O1 means icing, and O2 means xy, and it's O3, On. And when n goes to infinity, nu basically will be 1. And actually, in principle, in large n, and when n increase, eta will actually decrease. So when n increase, in principle, eta will decrease for large n. And when n goes to infinity, eta will be 0. But here, actually, it's not so monotonic. So these numbers are calculated with various kind of calculation, like epsilon expansion, but they're doing a Feynman diagram, and I think these people did like a 5 or 6 order of the epsilon expansion. And the Heitmeier expansion and the Monte Carlo, so this number is supposed to be pretty accurate. Why is the line here? Oh, okay, yeah, so I mean, I drew this line because this line is important, and when n equals to 2 and bigger, when n equals 2 and bigger, the number nu will be bigger than 2/3. Actually, bigger than 2/3 is very important. We are going to see why it's important later. But basically, for all the on, when n greater than or equal to 2, nu will be greater than 2/3. So this will be important. So. Okay, so how do we realize the Wilson-Fisher fixed point in a quantum model? So basically, to realize some fixed point in quantum model, basically we have to write down a quantum many-body model, like quantum spin model, and we tune some parameter driver ground state phase transition. So on one side we have some phase, the other side we have some other phase. Like this is a model which can realize the O3 Wilson-Fisher fixed point. It's not entirely trivial actually. For instance, this model like this. So this is a square lattice, and I define spin 1/2 on every side of a square lattice, and then make all the red bond have coupling, have the Heisenberg coupling J, and I make all the green bond has Heisenberg coupling lambda times J, and then I tune lambda, and tune lambda. Then we can imagine when lambda equals to 1. So when the green bond equals to red bond, the system will be at a new order, of course. And when lambda is very, very big, which means that when the green bound has a much stronger coupling to, compared with the red bound, then the system will have the kind of valence bound picture because these two spins on the green bound will singlet. So somewhere in between, there will be a quantum critical point where the new order completely suppressed, where the new order disappear. So this quantum critical point basically is actually O3 Wilson-Fisher fixed point because it satisfies all the philosophy of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. For instance, one side we have an order parameter with O3 invariance, and the other side we have the other side is actually completely disordered because this model actually breaks the lattice translation and the rotation symmetry already. So this model, although it's a valence bound solid, does not break any symmetry anymore. So basically, this phase actually is completely disordered. There's no symmetry breaking at all. So that's why this transition is actually a ordinary ordinary O3 Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So you probably know that. I mean, some of you may know that there's another model called the JQ model, which means that we start with a new order, we can tune that parameter drive to a valence bound solid order. But in that model, it turns out that the system does not, I mean, the Hamiltonian does not break the lattice translation and rotating symmetry at all. So there, the transition between new and a valence bound solid is not O3 Wilson-Fisher anymore. There, the transition will be something called deconfined criticality, which I probably will discuss next time. Not this time. And also another interesting that Stefan brought to my mind the other day is that suppose I design the model in a little different way. For instance, I also give the green bond and red bond on the lattice, but instead of a columnar pattern of the green bond, I give a staggered pattern of the green bond. Just the green bond here and here, just staggered pattern of green bond. Then I can also drive a phase transition between new order and some staggered pattern of the valence bond solid order. But there, the transition will not be O3 Wilson-Fisher as well. So I will also discuss that next time when I discuss the deconfined criticality. Okay, so this is O3 Wilson-Fisher. Okay, so now let me talk a little bit about dynamical scaling exponent, basically the number z, which is the ratio between the scaling dimension of time and scaling dimension of the space. So like this model is like a 3D icing kind of field theory. So this field theory describes the quantum phase transition in a transverse field quantum icing model. This is like the first model people will study when people study the quantum phase transition. Basically, we have like an icing type of coupling sigma z here, and we have a transverse field coupling sigma x. And when h over k is big enough, it's a transition between a icing symmetry breaking phase and icing symmetry not breaking phase. So this transition is described by this kind of 3D icing, 2+1 dimensional icing model. So this model has z equals to 1, basically because we cannot write down this kind of term, phi partial tau term, because this term will vanish. you can do integral bipolar system will vanish. So this kind of model, we have z equals 1. But I mean, in many, many cases, we have z equals 2. And the standard, I mean, the standard example is actually the Bose-Hubbard model. I'm sure all the code atom people, you know, I mean, know it better than I do. So we have this kind of Bose-Hubbard model defined on any kind of lattice. And there are two tuning parameters. One is a T over U. The other is a mu over U. So there's a model instrument lobe here. And there's a super fully phase here. And as the tip of the model insert lobe, I mean, if we zoom in the tip, we can sort of feel that there's a particle hole symmetry. Sort of feel like there's a particle hole. I mean, in bosonic system, there's only no exact particle hole symmetry, but suppose we zoom in as the tip, we can see that there's an approximate particle hole symmetry here. So this tip of the model insert lobe will have a z equals to 1 scaling. Because this kind of term, the linear term, will be 0 at this tip. But anywhere else, at here, for instance, here and here, here. So in other places where we don't have the emergent particle hole symmetry, then the transition will be z equals 1. Z equals 2. This term will be non-zero. We have z equals 2. And actually, it turns out that even at the tip, although this linear time derivative is 0, we can have like some omega the cube term. For instance, we can have some term, looks a little bit weird, but I think it should be there. Something like partial tau to something looks like this. So this term will break the particle hole symmetry because of the bosonic system, there's no exact particle hole symmetry. So basically this term, I mean, so at the tip, you only tune the linear term to 0, but we can have the kind of a cubic time derivative term. But those terms are irrelevant. If you count the power, those terms are strongly irrelevant, which means they do not affect the low energy dynamics at all. So that's why we say the emergent particle hole symmetry is exact in the infrared, because those terms are irrelevant. Okay, so suppose we...
That would be an assumption the quadratic is order 1. But can you have a situation where the dt precise group term is vanishing?
Sorry, this one?
Yeah.
This one is finite. It doesn't go away. It's just there.
So depending on the particular model, right?
Yeah.
But in symmetry, can you allow it? But the question is.
Oh, well. I mean, let's just say it's an order 1. I mean, it's not infinitesimal. It's not infinitesimal. Okay, yeah, so let's rewrite this model a little bit. Yeah, let's just introduce xy vector phi, two component vector phi, as a real and imaginary part of the complex order parameter psi. And then this model becomes this, just a very simple algebraic calculation. I show this model is this. Then if I view the xy order parameter, the xy vector phi as some in-plane magnetization of some spin system, then actually this model describes a z equals 2 transition, some z equals 2 xy magnetic transition in a quantum spin system. And this special form here actually describes a Larmor precession, which means if we have a z direction polarization already, we have a term on z direction magnetic field, then xy spin will rotate in space. And this is what this term means. This term means that if we have a z direction field, then we have like a Larmor precession of the xy spin. And it turns out this theory actually describes some phase transition in this particular material. This material is a strongly coherent material, so I just know that, so I found out that the Chinese people are the first people, to use the kind of material. Basically, this kind of some color is some color people used on the ancient statue of warriors. It's called China purple. Although it doesn't look purple, but actually, this color is called China purple. So. Okay, so this material have this kind of layered structure, kind of layered square lattice structure, and on every side of the square lattice, there's like two copper ion on every side, and they are very, very close to each other, so which means that the Heisenberg coupling within every bond is very strong, so J is the strongest, and then the interbond coupling J prime is weaker, and then the interlayer coupling J. Go with JF. JF is even weaker. So we have like J much bigger than J prime, much bigger than JF. It's kind of so you can imagine the ground state of a system is probably just going to be this kind of some singlet formed within every site of a square lattice. Some valence bond forming here, here, here. So it's kind of a ground state. However, suppose we turn on very strong magnetic field, we can split the, so the ground state will be spin zero. And the excited state on every side will be some spin one excitation, some triple excitation, SD equals to 1, 0, -1. So if I turn on a very strong magnetic field, then actually I can split this threefold degenerator spin one band, split into three band, SD equals 1, 0, and -1. Then actually turns out that if I increase the magnetic field stronger and stronger, then in the end, the SD equals the -1 band will get condensed. It's going to go down to the SD equals 0 band. So this transition will induce the XY condensation. It will induce the triplon condensation. And this phase transition, because the system already breaks time inversal symmetry, is going to be described by this kind of field theory. It's also going to be Z equals 2. OK, then the next example is like the Hertz-Mellis theory in the Fermi liquid, which will give us a Z equals 3. The standard theory. So basically, we have Hertz-Mellis theory basically describes some phase transition in Fermi liquid. Basically, all the parameters will couple linearly with the Fermi surface. We have the order parameter phi, which is actually we can take it as a ferromagnetic order parameter phi, and it's going to couple to the Fermi surface like this. And because it couples to the Fermi surface like this, turns out that actually the order parameter phi can decay into particle-hole pair excitation, and particle-hole excitation on the Fermi surface. And how did it couple the Fermi survey? It turns out that suppose the order parameter phi carry a very small momentum q, and the q is much, much smaller than the kf, than the Fermi wave vector, then it means that this order parameter phi can kick the entire, can move the entire Fermi surface from this position to this position. And the coupling between phi and the Fermi will be will be strongest as an intersection between these two Fermi surfaces. This is because at the intersection, the particle-hole excitation has the lowest energy. Because suppose we create a particle-hole excitation from here to here, it's going to cost a big energy because the Fermi velocity is very big. But suppose I create a particle-hole excitation from here to here, it's going to cost very little energy because it's going to be tangential with the Fermi surface. Okay, so now suppose I do a very standard calculation, I just integrate out the fermion by doing the kind of one-loop calculation. When you calculate the renormalized boson self energy, turns out that the boson self energy we have a very singular correction. It's going to be like omega over q, this kind of a correction. So this is a very, very singular term. And turns out that suppose I put this term in the boson free energy, in the boson Lagrangian, just putting omega over q here, then turns out that if I want to make sure every term here has the same scaling dimension, it means that omega we have a scaling dimension 3, and q have scaling dimension 1. So the entire system, so the entire dimension here will be d plus 3. If we are consider a two-dimensional system, it will be a five-dimensional system, effectively. So this means that if I count the power, the G will be -1. Count the power very, very naively, then G will be -1, have scaling dimension -1. So this means that this term will be irrelevant. So this means that this transition will be, most naively will be a mean field transition. It will be a five-dimensional mean field transition. Certainly if we calculate higher loop diagrams, situation might be different, but that's not so well understood yet. So let me just do the most naive thing. Take Z equal 3 and consider this as the mean field transition. And again, if we know it's a mean field transition and we know it's Z equal 3, then I can go back to calculate the correction from the quantum critical fluctuation to the fermions. We can calculate the fermion self energy like this. Calculate one loop using the dressed photon. Using the dressed boson propagator to calculate the fermion self energy using the Feynman diagram. Then we can see that the fermion self energy will be like this, omega to 2/3 times sine omega. So this will dominate the linear omega term in the free fermion Green's function. So this means that in the fermion Green's function, I get something singular, more singular than the linear omega term. So this means that if we calculate the spectral function of the fermion, I will not get a pole. Okay, there's no pole when we calculate the fermion Green's function. So this means that at the quantum critical point, there's no well-defined lambda quasi particle. Okay, so at the quantum point, the fermion will have a non-fermion liquid behavior. Okay, this is the
question. So when you integrated out fermions right at a critical point, you assume it was Fermi liquid. So even if it's not a Fermi liquid, how does one justify the whole calculation?
Sorry?
When you integrated out the fermions, when you calculated at loop, you assumed it was a Fermi liquid in that calculation.
Right.
Later we found it's not. So
I know. You can either do self-consistent calculation, or you can calculate more and more loop diagram. Like, you know, it's like if you want to take that into account, you have to calculate some higher loop diagram, like you know, do the kind of the kind of higher loop diagram to get a correction. I mean, this part is not so well understood yet. I mean, whether all the results here will hold as the, I mean, sum over all the five diagrams is not so well understood yet. So I'm just saying that within the one loop or this is probably a two loop, and within the one loop and two loop order, actually this will hold. So.
And what about other people saying it's first order?
Sorry. That's also come from higher loop corrections. You can show that G actually can change sign if you calculate.
You're not mentioning, loop. So you're objecting?
Sorry?
You're objecting to this?
No, I'm not objecting. I'm just saying, if I do the most naive thing, it will be like this.
Must it always be first order, or it can be both first and second order?
Sorry?
Should it be only first order only, or it can be both first and second order?
Both. I mean, when it's a first order, you can actually split into two phase transition as well. So I mean, when you say something in the first order, actually it implies that many other things
which
can happen.
Just be just second order transition.
It can. What I'm saying is it's not so well understood. So I'm not saying it's. So I'm not giving you a definite answer. I'm just showing you the example of the equal three phase transition. So. Yeah. Okay. So we do the same. If we do the same thing for the anti-Fermi order. We take, I mean, oh, it's not anti-Fermi, it's just a supernatant wave order parameter. It's the kind of a wave vector, QAF. And suppose QAF connect two arbitrary points on the Fermi surface. And the Fermi velocity as the two points are not parallel to each other. This is the criterion. As long as the Fermi velocity on the two points are not parallel to each other, then we get, I mean, again, we calculate the kind of, this kind of loop diagram, one loop diagram. I get a linear omega term. So this means that this transition is equals two. If you want to make sure these two terms are same again, dimension, it's z equals two. And again, I go back to calculate the fermion propagator using the kind of loop diagram. It's going to be omega to 1/2, the square root of the omega. So this will be, again, it will have the non-Fermi liquid behavior as a quantum point. I mean, only as these two hotspot, only at these two points on the Fermi surface. Yeah, okay, so I'm going to, so now I'm going to use some power counting.
Can you go back to the
slide? Okay, sure.
So for the case when you have a lasting, like when the Fermi surface is, you know, it's Fermi.
What happened? I cannot go back, I can only go forward.
Just this one.
Okay.
So you may model where the Fermi surface is lasting, right? So that we have to end Fermi in an order.
Yeah.
So you still have z equal to
no. That will be different. Actually, you don't even have nesting. As long as there's the Q wave vector is connecting these two points, when the Fermi wave vector are parallel to each other, then the answer will be different. Mm-hmm. You don't get omega here anymore. You get something very similar, omega over square root Q. Some omega over square root Q. So that's going to be z equals to 5/2. Something like that. So that's very singular. But there you get some extremely thick term at the, you know, there you get some very thick term at higher order as well. So that will be, I mean, that theory will behave very bad. So this will be the simplest case when these two points are not so parallel. So, yeah. Yeah, okay. So I'm going to do some power counting for various systems. For instance, suppose I couple my quantum quantity point to some random potential, for instance, to some random potential VR. And the random potential means that over space, they only have, random potential means the potential is static over time. If you calculate the time correlation, it's going to have a long range correlation over time, but only have a short range correlation in space, have a delta this kind of correlation in the space. So this means that the V, this potential, we have scaling dimension D over 2. Okay, because of this kind of correlation, has given d over 2. And now I want to, now since the vr coupled to phi square, phi is our order parameter, v coupled to phi square, so I want to see whether the disorder or the random potential is relevant perturbation or irrelevant perturbation as a quantum critical point or not. Okay, so basically if I do that, actually I just do some power counting. For instance, v has scalar dimension d over 2. And before I said phi square have scaling dimension d plus z minus 1 over nu, right? So the entire scaling dimension here will be 3d over 2 plus z minus 1 over nu. So to see whether this term is relevant or irrelevant, I just use the scan dimension of this term to compare it with the total dimension d plus z. So I use d plus z minus this, and turns out I get this. Okay. So suppose this term, I mean, suppose this number is positive, then this term will be relevant. If it's negative, then this term is irrelevant. So it boils down to comparing nu to 2 over d, actually. It boils down to comparing nu to 2 over d. Okay, that's why I said comparing nu to 2/3 is important. Because you know, if nu is, I mean, for three-dimensional transition, like for three-dimensional Wilson-Fischer phase transition, d equals to 3, and if nu is greater than 2/3, then the random potential is irrelevant. So which means that the Wilson-Fischer fixed point is stable against the random potential. But suppose the nu is smaller than 2/3, the random potential is relevant. Then this actually, this criterion is called Harris criterion. Okay.
Object because we have counter examples definitely. It
doesn't okay.
mean that it's irrelevant. It just says okay, maybe it's irrelevant.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, okay. Fine. I'm just giving you the simplest case. Okay. Simplest possible case.
Well, it's a good idea to suspect maybe it's irrelevant, but it's not a proof it's irrelevant.
Okay. Fine. Fine.
I think it's more based on the tree level power counting.
Yeah. Just power counting. Just some simple power counting. Give you the simple.
Suppose you go counter
example is counter example.
Yeah. Okay. So. Okay, so I mean, it turns out that we can do similar thing for other kind of situation. For instance, we can also couple like phi square to a Fermi surface. So before I couple the phi linearly to phi to a Fermi surface, but here I want to couple phi square to a Fermi surface, phi square times psi dagger psi, for instance. So now again, let me do the simplest one loop calculation. I integrate the psi and I generate some term coupling phi square here. So it's phi square times omega over k times another phi square. So basically just replace a phi by phi square in our previous slide. Okay, so again I want to consider whether this term is relevant or irrelevant as the quantum critical point. So the most naive thing we do is that again we can count the power. We can count the power. So it turns out that first again, so omega over k is actually a very singular momentum frequency dependence. Has a very singular momentum frequency dependence. So which means that if I do some RG calculation to some like rescale the ultraviolet cutoffs, this kind of some momentum shell integrates this kind of RG calculation, I'm not going to renormalize the vertex. So vertex will not be, you know, so we are not getting any vertex correction here for this singular vertex correction. So which means that all the correction will come to separately to this part and also this part. Okay, so all the correction will go separately to this part and also this part. So the scaling dimension of this term, basically just this part plus this part. Okay, this is the total scaling dimension. Okay, so now we can evaluate whether J is relevant or irrelevant. Basically, we use the same kind of techniques. Just to compare the total scaling dimension of this part to the D plus Z, using D plus Z minus the total scaling dimension. Again, I get something like 2 over nu minus D minus Z. So which means that, I have to compare nu to 2 over the total dimension, which is the sort of the same criteria as the Harris criteria. Okay. So I mentioned before that for all the ON Wilson-Fischer fixed point where n is greater than or equal to 2, the nu is greater than 2/3, which means that in this kind of situation, actually for all the ON with n greater than 2, all the parameter coupling in the Fermi surface becomes irrelevant based on the kind of most naive analysis.
Can I ask a question also, just be about Nikolai? So there is a very simple example of a system, this non-analytic coupling, when you just have classical system is interaction of the form 1 divided by R to some arbitrary power. And so you know that this thing can actually renormalize below an appropriate critical dimension. So how do we distinguish situations when non-analytic contributions renormalize from situations like what you mentioned, where omega divided by k is not supposed to renormalize? So how do we know when we can just tells that, okay, let's expand the
Lorentz
series and tells that
can I give a more, can I say a more specific, like 1 of R to which power?
There's a very old paper. People just repeated, from 1975 probably, people just repeated standard calculations for phi to the fourth theory. So corrections there.
Well, so do they get the vertex correction to that vertex though, or I mean I have to check that. Basically, you know, I mean it's better to give a more specific example, like 1 over R to which power, then we can start it.
Power.
I mean 1 over R to arbitrary power does not mean that it's going to be or singular.
It's not an integer power of k.
Yeah, sure, of course, but it's okay.
So the question is basically, is it just again a hand waving state?
I mean, I mean, you can
something of,
actually,
NK,
yeah, actually, I mean, I try to calculate vertex correction myself here. I did not get any vertex correction. You can try to do it.
You do something of expansion and powers of omega k, and so on. No Taylor expansion can normalize this thing, right?
Sorry,
if you do any Taylor expansion and powers of omega and k, you can never renormalize omega divided by k. So that's if you assume that you are allowed to proceed this way, then you can never get any.
Yeah, right. If you proceed into certain procedures, then you're not going to get this. Yeah, okay. So actually we can actually this might be relevant to some cold atom problem. If we consider this kind of a boson, the kind of model insert a superfluid transition buried inside a Fermi C. For instance, you consider another Fermi C, you know, suppose you consider the kind of a boson Hubble model and couple to another Fermi surface, for instance. Then this kind of transition describes this kind of a field theory. Again, you have a boson part coupled to the Fermi C part, like this. And then again, we can do the same thing we did in the previous slide. We integrate the fermions, and then we get this kind of a singular term. And then this means that as the tip, so first of all, so away from the tip, then this term will certainly be irrelevant because omega have a scale dimension 2 and k have a scale dimension 1. So this term will be clearly irrelevant. But as the tip of the model insert lobe, then actually turns out that based on my previous slide, then it means this term will also be irrelevant based on the most naive power counting. And this term will be irrelevant as well. Okay. So this might be somehow related to some co-atom boson Fermi mixed system in co-atom system. Okay, so the next one is some phase transition with coupled with superfluid. So this was started by Leon actually, like a long time ago, I think. So this one again, supposed to be considered some phase transition coupled with the superfluid backgrounds. By superfluid background, I mean that the order parameter will couple to the Goldilocks mode fluctuation. For instance, phi square is the square of the order parameter, coupled to the Goldilocks mode like this, delta n equals to a partial tau theta. And partial tau theta basically describes the delta n density fluctuation. And then again, I can integrate the Goldilocks mode, just to do the direct loop calculation, I get something like this. The phi square omega square over omega square plus k square. So again, this term, if we do the kind of naive moment and shell kind of type of RG, actually this term will not be renormalized at all. So this term is like a stable vertex operator in the RG. So again, the scale dimension of the entire order, of the entire term will be this part plus this part. So we can do the same kind of power counting as we did before, and then again, this term will be irrelevant when n is greater than 2. Like for all kinds of phase transition with n greater than 2, then this term will be irrelevant. Okay. This was started by Leon like 15 years ago, I think. Yeah, okay. So the last topic about the conventional phase transition, conventional critical point, conventional quantum critical point is this kind of a classical phase transition with effective dynamical scaling. This was actually started by Aharoni and D. Fisher like in the 70s. So suppose we consider an icing-like magnet. But the icing order parameter is to have this kind of dipole interaction in three-dimensional space time. In three-dimensional space, this is the classical phase transition. So, like a dipole interaction will look like this. Okay, and in momentum space, a dipole interaction become a kz square over k square. In momentum space, just do a Fourier transformation, it will be a kz square over k square. Okay, so now the free energy in the momentum space will be kz square over k square plus k square times the phi square. We'll have this kind of form. So now we can see that this term actually behaves like a z equals 2 phase transition because I can just take all the kx, ky have scale dimension 1 and kz have scale dimension 2. Okay, then this part will be scaling invariant. So this means that this free energy actually have effectively has a z equals 2. Okay, so effectively this phase transition will be as a four-dimensional phase transition because d plus z equals 4. Now. Okay, so we can do all kind of, so we can do all the kind of effective four-dimensional analysis to this kind of phase transition in three-dimensional classical phase transition. And it was started in the late 70s. Yeah, okay, so this actually is all about a conventional quantum quantity point. So I'm going to move on to the unconventional quantum quantity point. The first example of the unconventional quantum quantity point is the confined deconfined phase transition of the Z2 gauge field. Most people know that a confined deconfined phase transition of the Z2 gauge field is a 3D Ising transition, but actually we are going to see that it actually has a lot more, has a lot more possibility than just the Ising transition itself. So these two gauge fields defined like this. First of all, we define the Pauli matrix sigma z and sigma x on the links of the square lattice, for instance. We can also do this on any lattice, of course. Let's take the square lattice for example. So we define sigma z and sigma x on the links of the square lattice. Okay. Then there's a gauge constraint, which means that the product of sigma x around every vertex is 1. We impose the gauge constraint. And then the Hamiltonian of the two gauge field is like a product of sigma z around every placate times k minus transverse field h times sigma x. Sigma is defined on every link. It's kind of a Hamiltonian. Then by tuning h over k, we can drive a phase transition between a confined phase and deconfined phase. So a confined phase means that if I calculate the Wilson loop is just product of sigma z on a very big loop, for instance, then it's going to fold off at like exponential of minus a, and a is the area of the Wilson loop. It's called area law. And for the deconfined phase, if you calculate the same Wilson loop, it's going to be a parameter law, just going to fold off as the parameter of the Wilson loop. And there's a phase transition. And for this simplest case, the phase transition is a 3D Ising transition. And let me remind you how that happens. So basically, we can do the duality transformation and go to the dual site. And the dual lattice site basically is the placate center of every square, the placate center of every square. So basically, to solve the constraint, we can solve the gauge constraint by introducing tau z and tau x on the dual side. Once I define sigma x equals the product, this sigma x equals the product of this tau z, these two tau z, and the sigma x here equals the product of between these two tau z. Okay. If I do this, then turns out we can see that this gauge constraint is solved automatically. Okay, the gauge constraint becomes solved automatically. Then this Hamiltonian becomes a transverse field Ising model defined on the dual lattice side. Okay. Become a transverse field Ising model defined on the dual lattice side. Tau z is defined on the placate center of the square lattice. So since now the model become a transverse field quantum Ising model, then of course the transition will be 3D Ising transition. So this is like the most standard, the simplest case of the confined deconfined transition. Okay. So now suppose I modify the Z2 gauge theory a little bit. For instance, instead of a product of sigma equals 1, I get a product of sigma equals minus 1. Okay, I get this kind of situation. Then here, again, I want to solve this kind of gauge constraint. I'm going to define sigma x here equals the product of sigma z, sigma x here equals another product of sigma z. But somehow on this link, I have to take sigma x equals minus tau z, just to make sure that the product is minus 1, for instance. So one of the four links, I have to make sure that sigma x equals to minus tau z defined here. Okay. So this actually means that now this model is dual to a fully frustrated quantum Ising model. So a fully frustrated quantum Ising model means that, again, the quantum Ising model is defined on the dual lattice side of the square lattice, the tau z and tau s defined on the placate center. However, on all the green dashed bound, the Ising coupling is minus. It's negative, but on all the red dashed bound, the Ising coupling is positive. We have negative Ising coupling and the positive Ising coupling. So now this kind of quantum Ising model is called a fully frustrated because we can see that for all the positive coupling, I want tau z to be aligned parallelly, but for the green bound, I want tau z to align anti-parallelly. So there's no way to make all the tau z happy in this model. So this is why we call it a fully frustrated Ising model. And actually, fully frustrated the transverse field Ising model. So how do we analyze the model in a systematic way? turns out that we can just imagine that tau z, we can soften the tau z. I mean, so we can replace tau z by a real scalar, by a real scalar number, by a real scalar boson number. Then calculate the band structure of the real scalar band. I mean, for the real scalar. Then turns out I realized that in the Brillouin zone of the real scalar, turns out I have like two minima. In the Brillouin zone, I have two different minima. And if I choose the gauge, the two minima will locate a Q and a minus Q, like one minima here and another minima here. So this means that I have to expand all the parameter tau z into two momentum Q and a minus Q. And then all the parameter will become complex instead of a real. Okay, all the parameter become complex. So this means that now if I want to consider a phase transition, a transport field, fully frosted quantum icing model, then this transition will be described by a complex order parameter instead of a real order parameter. So complex order parameter will look like this. It's a partial mu phi squared, I mean standard term, plus another term, phi to 4 term. So we have a phi to 4 term here because of this momentum is a pi over 2. It's like a pi over 2, so which means that it has a z4 conservation instead of just a u1 conservation. So we are allowed to write down a phi to 4 term here in the Lagrangian. So which means that now this phase transition is a 3D xy phase transition with a z4 anisotropy, and there are many numerical evidence suggesting that this z4 anisotropy on a xy transition is irrelevant. So this means that this transition is a 3D xy universality class phase transition. So which means that suppose I modify the z2 gauge field like this, if I do this product sigma is equal to minus 1, I'm going to get a 3xy phase transition between the confined phase and deconfined phase. And actually, in condensed matter system, more often than not, I'm going to get a product sigma equal to minus 1 instead of 1. Because in condensed matter system, the z2 gate field usually coupled to some spin-down, either Fermion or bosonic spin-down on every side. And actually, the product sigma x will equal to minus 1 to the Fermion number. And in most cases, the field is 1, so which means the product sigma equals to minus 1 to 1 equals to minus 1. So actually, in condensed matter system, more often than not, we encounter this is called the odd z2 gauge field instead of an even z2 gauge field. So this actually is more likely to happen in condensed matter.
Just one question. So if I had a rectangular symmetry, is it the same even then? Instead of square symmetry, if I had a rectangular?
Triangle? Oh, it's going to be different. This is the next time. This is the next thing I'm going to talk about. So we can also do the same thing on the triangular lattice. Again, we define a z2 gate field on a triangular lattice. Again, we define sigma z on the triangles, on the triangle links. And then also so we can also consider the confined deconfined phase transition for the z2 gate field on the triangular lattice. Again, to study the transition, we also go to the dual lattice side. We go to the dual picture, which means that I define the dual variable on the placate center of the triangles. I define a dual variable on the triangle placate center. So this means that this placate, this side will form a honeycomb lattice. Okay, so basically the dual lattice side is a honeycomb lattice. So now, suppose I make our z2 gate field odd, which means the product of sigma x around every side is a minus 1, then the dual model will become a fully frustrated icing model on the honeycomb lattice. The fully frustrated icing model on the honeycomb lattice. Then again, let me solve the band structure on the band structure of the order parameter for the fully frustrated icing model on the honeycomb lattice. Turns out that I have four minima, I have four degenerate minima in the Brillouin zone.
Why is there four? There's three fold or six fold symmetry.
Sorry?
The lattice has six fold symmetry.
No, actually, when you pick a gauge, it breaks the rotation symmetry of the lattice. But actually, different lattice, when you change the gauge, the four minima will rotate. But actually, all the physical quantity you calculate will be gauge independent. So the position of the four will just some artificial thing, just a gauge dependent thing. So this actually means that we have four minima. So now if I write down the field theory if I expand the icing order parameter as the four minima, and I write down the field theory based on the some symmetry transformation and gauge symmetry, then I'm going to realize the phase transition is a 3D04 phase transition. Up to the sixth order, it will be a 3D04. I mean, actually the quartic order, it will be a 3D all four phase transition. So this means that the confined-deconfined transition for the odd Z2 gauge field on the triangular lattice is a 3D O4 transition instead of 3D Ising transition. So it has a pretty nice application. We can easily, I mean, so we can consider the kind of a spinly equated valence bound solid transition of the triangular lattice quantum diode model. I mean, so there's a famous triangular lattice quantum diode model. Actually, it shows there's a spin liquid, there's a spin liquid phase, stable Z2 spin liquid phase. And certainly, I mean, suppose we tune the parameter of the triangular lattice quantum diode model, I can drive a phase transition between a valence bound solid order and a Z2 spin liquid phase. And then this transition will be a 3D O4 phase transition. So this will be something which I think the numerical people can try to check whether it's correct or not. This is something very, very nice to check.
So in the triangular lattice, you mentioned diamond model, right?
Right.
So in the triangular lattice diamond model, there are different kinds of valence bound solid state. Right?
Yes.
So and you're describing a Z2 gauge field combined and deconfined transition, and
right.
there are only two phases there.
No, the confined phase will have the degenerate, valence bound solid order.
Oh, it's because of the.
Oh, thing. Actually, did I not mention this? Actually, I mean, for instance, for the square lattice case, actually, we can imagine when you have this kind of constraint, and in the confined phase, which means when H is very big. I certainly want to have this kind of, certainly I cannot have sigma equals 1 on every link. I would make sure one of them is minus 1, for instance. Turns out that in the confined phase, the minus 1 link will form the kind of columnar order with the valence bound solid order.
Yeah, in triangle?
In triangle, it's the same thing. Basically, having kind of minus 1 bond will form the kind of columnar, will form columnar pattern. This is the valence bound. I mean, it's valence bound order, and it's also the confined phase of the Z2 gauge field, of the diamond model as well. So. Yeah, okay, so I'm getting close to 1 hour, so this is the last topic. Okay.
We start 5 minutes later, so
okay.
Minutes.
Okay, so now let me move on to the confined-deconfined transition of the U1 gauge field, for instance. So I'm going to focus on the three-dimensional U1 gauge, 3+1-dimensional U1 gauge field. So we know that the Maxwell equation describing the 3+1-dimensional gauge field actually is self-dual, which means that the electric field and magnetic field are dual to each other. Like the electric short and the magnetic monopole are due to each other, for instance. And actually, the confined-deconfined transition of the U1 gauge field in a compact U1 gauge field in 3+1 dimension actually is driven by the condensation of the monopole of the magnetic charge. So how do we see the condensation of the magnetic monopole charge? The magnetic monopole will actually give a confined phase. So let's imagine, let's consider a dual case. For instance, if I consider we condense the electric charge, if I condense electric charge, which means condensing electric charge is like a superconductor, then the gauge field will enter a Higgs phase in the superconductor. Then actually, so we know that in a superconductor, the magnetic flux will not expand in space. We are localizing one line. We are localizing a flux. We are localizing. So this is like a magnetic flux. We are localizing a flux in a superconductor. So which means that two monopole with a positive minus charge, we want to separate them. There's a magnetic string, there's a flux string between them. And the energy cost will be proportional to the length of the string. Okay, will be proportional to the length of the string. So this means that in a superconductor, the magnetic charge is confined. Okay. So in the dual side, suppose I induce a magnetic charge condensate, which is like a magnetic monopole superconductor, then the electric charge will also be confined. Because in a magnetic charge condensate, the electric field will be localizing a flux. So two electric charge will, and when you want to separate them, there's a line tension between them for the electric charge, I mean for the electric flux.
So is this compact gauge field coupled to matter field or just the gauge field?
Oh, so far I assume the matter field is gapped.
So that when you mean the electric charge, what does it mean?
Oh, gapped electric charge.
Oh, I see.
Gapped electric charge. Yeah. Okay, so now I can describe the confined-deconfined transition using the kind of a monopole condensation, which the phi is the monopole field, which is the phase angle of the monopole field, and it's coupled to the U1 gauge field. And this U1 gauge field is a dual U1 gauge field, which means that this electric field of the U1 gauge field is actually the magnetic flux of the original U1 gauge field. So now we write down this kind of a field theory, and basically the phase transition is the Higgs transition, is a condensation of phi, for instance. And now suppose I want to calculate the universality class of the phase transition. And what I do is just do a perturbative calculation of the electric charge, the coupling constant here, and also G. And this is RG flow of the calculation. So the red curve is RG flow for G, and the green curve is RG flow for electric charge. So we can see here that the red curve actually, so G will first go to small on the RG flow, and then change sign and grow big. And the green charge, I mean the green line which describes electric charge will always go down, which means that the electric charge will always be screened weaker and weaker on the RG flow. But G will change sign on RG flow. Okay. And actually we know that in a Jensen Lambda theory, if the cardioid term is negative, then actually it can be a first order transition. Okay. In a Jensen Lambda theory, when G is negative, it becomes a first order transition. So this means that this system under a very long RG flow will become a first order transition. But it's probably going to be an extremely weak first order transition because G actually has to go to small first and then change sign. Okay. It's going to be an extremely weak first order transition. So for a very large length scale, so this theory will probably behave like a mean field like. I assume it's positive. That's the assumption you can.
Sometimes you can have even
sign. I know. So I'm just talking about the most likely case instead of the older cases. And if you do all the cases, actually the time is not enough. So let's just do the most likely case. Okay. Turns out this transition also has a very nice application. Suppose we consider a three-dimensional quantum dial model on the cubic lattice, for instance. And this is a quantum dial model on a cubic lattice. I have a dimer flipping term for two vertical to two horizontal. And there's a weight term giving the flippable weight. And then of course, when V is very, very, when V is negative and negative large, the system wants to form this kind of a degenerate valence bound solid pattern just to maximize the number of flippable plaquettes. For instance. So when V is negative and also very large, actually we are going to see the valence bound solid, this kind of pattern. And the valence bound solid is actually a confined phase. It's actually a confined phase. And actually when T over V is have the same order of magnitude, then there's a photon phase. There's a photon phase. So which means that the valence bound, dimer actually will resonate. You don't see any pattern. But suppose you calculate dimer correlation, it's going to give you a power law type of correlation. So it's called a photon phase. I don't have a picture of a photon, but actually this is a picture I copied from Xiaogang Wen's web page. Basically, like the fluctuating loops. It's the same as the fluctuating of the dimers. So there's a critical point. If you tune V over T, the critical point between valence bound solid and the photon phase. Then this transition, again, is described by condensation monopole. But now the monopole has more than one flavor. It has two flavors. The monopole have monopole become two complex boson. So this has become a 3+1 dimensional CP1 model for this kind of phase transition. So this is also something that people can check. And there's another type of model called the classical dimer model. Okay. Classical dimer is also very simple. You have the Hamiltonian, classical Hamiltonian, just give a weight to all the flippable parallel dimer configuration in a three-dimensional space. And then I define my partition function as a summation of all the dimer configuration with this weight. If I sum over all the dimer configuration with this weight. And then I drive a phase transition between a Coulomb phase when temperature is very high, I have a Coulomb phase with a power law dimer density correlation. And the low temperature have a valence bound solid order because this term actually will favor the system, the dimer to parallel, to a line parallel in a space. Then this transition is almost the same as the transition I mentioned in the previous slide. So previous slide I said the transition between valence bound solid and the photon phase is a 3+1 dimensional CP1 model. And here this transition is just a 3-dimensional CP1 model. Okay. And actually, this kind of three-dimensional CP1 model, there's a lot of conjecture about its universality class. And the general belief or the general hope is that this is a second-order transition. It's a conformal field theory, but there's no proof for that. Okay. Then combining these two, these two situations together, we have the kind of global phase diagram for the quantum dial model with temperature. So by tuning V over T, we have a phase transition between valence bound solid and the photon phase, and this is like almost a mean field transition, but eventually we'll become a first order, a very weak first order. And at finite temperature, there is a line of CP1 transition, and this is a Coulomb phase. So if you guys like to do numerical check on the model, it will be very interesting to check numerically. Okay, so I think it's a good time for me to stop. Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Well, let me start with the picture. Because if the CP1 is a nice transition line, but then it's almost first order at the end,
yeah,
then there must be some higher order critical point where it goes first order.
Yeah, you could, yeah.
And do you have any classification for...
No. No, I don't, sorry. No.
So do you have a good sense of what the crossovers look like in this sort of transition?
Crossover?
The finite temperature crossovers, like you still have sort of a fan of, you know, critical behavior and stuff.
Right, yeah. You mean here, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you can do the same similar kind of scaling, and you know, there's certainly a quantum critical region. Basically the since this is almost like mean field transition, the mu is 1/2 and z equals 1, so certainly there's a fan of quantum critical region here. And certainly there's like a quasi-classical region here around the phase transition. Those can be just calculated using the scaling. I mean, certainly you have to assume this is like, I mean, since it's almost mean field, which means that all the scaling has to be beyond a certain energy at time, beyond certain energy scale, and because you know, so strictly speaking, it's a first order transition. But actually, if you are beyond some energy scale, it will behave almost like mean field. So yeah.
One more question. The same question actually. Comment. So recently, actually, we found you can actually use the orbital shape
to
mimic the
quantum time
model.
Ah, this one.
Which can be called that.
Okay. Good.
Basically, you map the shape.
Shape of
it. This is the
extended
S-wave
will keep it. Oh, okay,
I see.
That is like
the
shape, right? Uh-huh.
So that's like the
map,
the shape of the state to the
diameter.
Okay.
In case people are interested in the program collection.
So in a sense,
this is a similar question. It's pretty all the examples, so unless I have slept one over, for the lattices were with the interactions which were multi body and plaquette or triangle that we excited on. So several particles were involved in that. So do you know any model in which you have this confined transition which you have only two bodies?
Sorry?
In which you would have only two body interactions. So
two body interaction.
Or is there any rigorous statement that it cannot be, right?
There's no rigorous statement like that.
Long-range interactions that you mentioned.
Long-range interaction? Well, I don't know any. Let's see. Do I know?
I guess in principle you can imagine doing perturbation to perturbation theory and derive forward interaction from two-body interaction.
Exactly.
So if you go to Kitaev's honeycomb model and you go to the different dimensions, that's most famous for its gapless phase, but actually the gap phase is exactly such as
Z2.
So all the ring change can be perturbation when you generate them.
You do perturbation theory around that phase, you will see that, you know, the toric curve is...
Is there sort of, this I know, of course, yeah. This is the same transition that the Z2.
And then if you turn on magnetic field, you get the same transition.
I mean, this actually is what.
That's the only example that is, so to say, claimed.
Well, that's an example of these two body interactions.
Well, actually, in one of the paper by Matthew Liang and Michael Hermely, this kind of a 3D photon on particle lattice, the model they started with is just a two body interaction, it's X and Z spin model. But the ring chain will be generated by like third order perturbation from the XY coupling. That actually becomes a photon, and it becomes this kind of. Six body interaction, but that's
I understand. Yeah, the problem is for us to go to the six
body interactions
with the perturbation theory is kind of difficult to reach these temperatures that are
required
because the things become very small. So it's much better to think in terms maybe of the things that, I don't know, Richard was talking, the Rydberg atoms, where you can really create many body interactions at once, like using mechanisms like Rydberg and other Rydberg blockade and things like that.
Actually, I was kind of hoping that for all the SUN story has been going on, some energy scale can gain a factor of n in front of it.
Yes.
That can enhance the energy scale of many ring chain term. I think like a year and a half ago, actually I had some proposal like this, but I don't remember the details right now. I didn't write it down. But there's some energy scale encoder system can gain a factor of n if you consider SUN instead of SU2.
Alright, we're gonna see
Chen
and Leon next time. What will we consider?
Okay.
So, next time.